Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Crime. LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM, Los Angeles.
102.3 FM, Riverside.
And 105.0 AM, Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. And of course, I'm Al Warren. Mr. David North Martino is somewhere around here.
In the house.
He's in here the house.
In the house.
You lost.
In the House of Mystery.
Would you like some candy? Oh, boy.
I don't know, Al. I don't know. Got to think about that.
Yeah, no, you need cheesecake or something like that. But no.
Oh, yeah, well, then I wouldn't think about that, no.
Yeah, yeah. So you're pretty happy Johnny Depp won. Hey, you're right behind that.
Was I?
Oh, I just thought I'd say that just so that we get
Yeah,
some,
you're just trying to get me in trouble.
That's right. I'm trying to turn you into a bad light here. They're always picking on me. I want some bad mail headed.
I'm not taking sides on this stuff.
Well, I heard that you dressed up like Amber Heard all the time, Amber Heard, and you had a little dress and you put on the wig and you do the whole thing. So,
well, that might be true.
Doesn't mean you're on her side, but
no.
Johnny Depp turned 59.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't realize he was that old, but no. I guess he is. Same age as me. Wow.
Wow.
Anyway,
that's crazy.
Well, now, speaking of nothing like Hollywood, anyway, we've got a writer, director, producer, punk band singer. He's just doing it all. And I don't know. Anyway, let's invite him in. That's Mr. P. David Ebersol. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely. I'm suddenly much more intrigued now that I know about all this Amber Heard cosplay going on.
Well, he scared one of our guests so badly when he was in a dress because his guest thought he was something, smoking a cigar and wearing a dress. And then once he saw Dave, that was like, oh my God.
That was it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, well. Yeah. It is Gay Pride Month. So.
Well, yeah, Dave doesn't need that. You know, the only thing I keep telling him,
kind of guy.
Yeah, well, you know, it's fine, but why he wears army boots to go with it, I don't. It's not the look, but
they're comfortable.
Right? Those Gay Pride parades, it's a long walk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I'm not even going there, boy, I'll tell you. Like he ever walks anywhere. Anyway, so you have quite the history here. I'm very impressed. Wow. So how did your life go this way? Like, how did you get into it? I mean, what went wrong? No, why are you like filmmaker, director? You've got all this stuff.
You know, it's funny because the motto of our company, the Ebersol Hughes Company, is we're always up to something. And it tends to be true. We kind of, don't like to get too boxed in, and we'll sort of, after we've done something for a while, we start thinking, well, what do we want to do now? So, I was an English major at UCLA before I went to NYU Film School. And so for me, the dream was always to write a book. I mean, that was the sort of top, achievement that I could sort of put on the list of things that I would hope that I would someday do in my life. And so I took this hard left turn into film school in 1986 and kind of never looked back. But last year, or 2 years ago, I guess now, you know, we had that crazy thing called the pandemic, and I had time. Oh. And well, so I'd had this book kind of cooking up inside of my head, and I thought, why don't I sit down and put my fingers where my mouth is.
Well, be careful. But I would have thought co-starring with Paula Abdul
well,
would be the dream of anybody.
And there you are. That was at 13 years old, and I did not peak. that tells you something about my life.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
but that is kind of an interesting story, which is that I was at that point, you know, theater arts kid, and somebody came into our junior high school auditorium and announced that they were casting a film, all kids, and it was a musical. And so I went to the audition. It was one of those cattle calls where people just lined up around the block. And when they brought you in, you had to dance, you had to sing, you had to act. And slowly but surely, I kept getting winnowed down until ultimately I won the lead part in this film.
Wow.
And we were 13, so Paula Abdul was not famous. She was just a girl who went to, you know, junior high school out in the valley.
Yeah.
And my husband, Todd, was going through memorabilia in our garage and looked into a box that my grandmother had given us. And he said, "Were you in a movie with Paula Abdul in 1977? And I was like, "You know, that's possible."
Oh, wow.
So it's funny, it's revived because you would think because of me, you know, and my illustrious career. But no, Paula Abdul has gone on to fame and fortune, and people continue to bring that film back up.
Wow. Yeah, she's done really well.
Yeah. Talented little girl.
Yeah. And your death in Venice. Now, that's quite an achievement too, right?
Well, Death in Venice, California, and it was it won Best Film, Best Director at AFI when I went to AFI Film School, and that was sort of my beginning of really entering the film industry. I was quite, blindsided by winning. It was exciting and very cool to be kind of singled out like that. But it helped me start. It was the first film that really got noticed. It ended up getting theatrically released. It's 30 minutes long, along with a 60-minute documentary on Paul Bowles, which of course, you know, me with my literary background was thrilling to me. So they liked the underpinnings of the Thomas Mann novella underneath my story. It also it's blended a little bit with Lolita as well, and so they liked that along with this, you know, literary documentary that was short, and it gave them a theatrical release. So, so that was my first, you know, foray out into the world.
Do you feel like, let's say, Hollywood, or let's just say the whole film industry, as well as now books, now that you've got this first book out, do you feel you have to be careful on being in a gay subject and how you present it?
Well, it's interesting because actually Death in Venice, California is the first gay themed film ever to win Best Film at AFI. And that was 1995. So back then they were still discouraging us from doing content. And somewhere along the line, I think it was my entertainment lawyer, when I think Queer as Folk and some other thing came out, she said to me, "You know, suddenly you're trendy. Like, you're everywhere, you people." So I actually don't think so, in that I do think that it helps to have a niche now. And right now the world is so noisy and there's so much content, so much information out there for people to have to weed through. So to have something that can be categorized, I think actually kind of helps people at least know what they're looking at, why they're looking at it. So I think at this point it becomes a bit of a plus.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's all true, but of recent times, do you think that, I think what I'm getting at is there's always a certain presentation of how gay people should be, how they should appear, what they should say, how they should act and things like that. And I just wonder if that sort of interferes in how you present something.
Oh, that's interesting. You mean like, you know, do I feel any kind of responsibility or do I have some sort of, idea of limitations on what I'm allowed to express? I have never really felt that way or thought about it in those terms. And usually what I think is that if I'm scared to put it down into print, whether it's a, you know, screenplay format or book format now, I should do it, because personally, I feel like if it makes me nervous, then it probably is good. so if I'm afraid of the buttons that I might push, or if I'm afraid that it might, I don't know, draw some kind of attention towards me or something like that. I usually don't shy away from it, but that's kind of personal. I understand what you're saying. And I think that it's true that there is a lot of thought going around what is kind of correct. And we do it. What I think about it is that it's great because after all these years of nobody giving a crap about it and just doing and saying whatever they wanted, no matter how hurtful, we actually now have to take a second and say, is that right? Is that wrong? We made a movie with Cher about her family, and you know, Chaz had just transitioned. And so kind of getting they, them, there correct at that moment was very hard for her, for Cher, and for us, like even, you know, dealing with and interviewing Chaz. So, it, you know, there's been a lot of conversation around all of these things. And I actually think that, that in the end, after we get through with how awkward it is to have to think every time before we speak, that eventually I think it's going to be an extremely positive thing for the culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Americans aren't used to thinking before they speak.
No, we're not.
Is that the bottom line here?
we're a sloppy nation.
Yeah. I think it's all good, but I just worry about things getting altered away from what they really are. I mean, there's a lot of people that don't really understand gay life, let's say, and they're not in it, but they're supportive. But I think
things getting altered from the way they are, from your perspective, I think is the thing that's interesting. We were making, we got hired once to do a commercial, and we were doing decades. And the woman who was the producer of it was African American, and we were doing the 60s, thinking it was jubilant. And she said, you know, that's a very hard period for me. That's a very hard period for my family. And we were like, you know, take a seat back and think about, you know, your perspective might not be the same as everybody else's perspective on,
right,
on how things are, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
No, it is true. I mean, I hear that because, you know, even the sentiment that, you know, back in the good old days where things were better, make America great again, you know, that if you really thought about the 60s and all the assassinations and the Black Panthers and Charles Manson and all the other things going on, it people just have this flawed idea of what things, how good they were.
And the lack of opportunity. I love Dolly Parton's song in the good old times when things were bad.
Yeah. It's just, I think it's a sense of realism that people don't always get, you know? Well, that's interesting. So how did you get onto the book? Now, 99 Miles from L.A., and it's an interesting title, interesting book, and it's a little surprising. It wasn't quite what I expected. It's a good thing, not a bad thing. I was shocked. So how did this happen?
Right. It really germinated from going to see a Johnny Mathis concert. A good friend of ours, Donna Lauren, who's like a songbird from the 60s. I don't know if you know her. She was in the Beach Blanket Bingo movies and Dr. Pepper Girl. Super cool. She hosted Shindig. And it was her birthday, and she took us to a Johnny Mathis concert. And he sang this song live on stage that I'd never heard before, 99 Miles from L.A. And I literally took out my iPhone and filmed it just because I wanted to remember the song. And so it began to kind of germinate in me, this idea. It sounds almost like a kind of positive, hopeful song in that the lead character of the song is driving towards his lover and hoping that the relationship will still be there, but you can just tell it's doomed. so you can just tell he's just got his mind full of nonsense and memory. And so that kind of idea of a relationship and that, I don't know, kind of lack of understanding of the hopefulness that you might have for it working out, success, love, you know, really coming your way, started something in me about characters and ideas. And I'm often sort of working in the land of noir in my writing. And to me, it dovetailed really nicely together with that, in that I really feel like when noir flourishes in our culture, it's because we've lost faith in the idea that things will indeed work out for us. we go over to the dark side because the light side isn't working, right? So we're willing to commit that crime or kill that person or do what's necessary to make our lives happen for ourselves because we no longer believe that staying on the side of good will pay off. And so those two ideas together, this sort of, you know, forlorn concept about love not working out and this noirish undertone.
So it's
really
we're
working together for me as I started.
So it's a real cozy love story.
Exactly. I always say, and that just seemed like a happy little jumping off point for
a book. Well, there you go. Well, do you find it a lot of fiction writers we speak to always kind of talk about their relationship with their characters and how the characters are important to them. They might be like their family, kids, friends, whatever. They always have these descriptions and they hear the voices or they see the pictures and stuff of these characters and stuff. What's your experience?
Well, I find that they really speak for me, and that once you define your characters well, they know what they want to do inside of any given scene that you put them into. And I've been calling this kind of autobiographical fiction, that there's a lot of me, myself, and I inside of all of the different characters. Nobody is me, but every character has a lot of details from my life, ideas from it. And I think it was around the time of Truman Capote's writing that people coined that term autofiction, with the idea that you take things from real life and then you subvert it into a story. And so I did a lot of that. And there's a lot of kind of, I don't know, banking of memories of things that I went through that then become a story pointer or a character moment. So they're not just important to me in a way. It's like, you know, they are me. And that's a very different thing, I think, than writing for cinema. There's a very clear separation, I think. It's not as personal, I don't find, when I'm writing screenplays as when I did this.
Well, do you use your experiences as an actor to create character?
Well, it's funny because I would never call myself an actor. I did it when I was a kid. but there has been a new experience that has been really interesting and fun, which is doing book readings. You have to read this thing aloud. And once again, knowing that they are me, and knowing or based out of myself, and then knowing that they are these characters who have to express themselves, you begin to have to act to read and let people sort of in on the feeling of the chapter, of the characters, etc. And so that has been helpful. But I think coming from that and coming from filmmaking in general, directing actors is, in a way, acting just through people who are good at it instead of you trying to do it yourself. And so you're digging under the idea of character, motivation, who people are. And, in my bio, I even talk about that I'm the son of a psychologist. And I think that in our house, that was always encouraged, the idea of making connections between people's choices and who they are and how they represent themselves. And then my stepfather was the city editor of the Los Angeles Times. He did the Metro section. I don't know if you remember that, if either of you are Angelinos, but the Metro section was like where they reported about the Hillside Strangler or, other kind of, crimes and misdemeanors going on in the city. And so it was all part of it when we were growing up. So I think a lot of that has come into the writing. I think a lot of those young experiences then inform the adult experience.
Do you ever worry about kind of exposing some of your own vulnerability by putting yourself and your feelings into some of the characters, especially in today's world? Because now everyone gets a hold of you now.
Right. Yeah. I'm less concerned about myself and more concerned about other people. Like, I think there's a lot of my family in chapter 16. So sometimes you think, oh God, mom, don't read that. But, as I'm kind of an open book. I don't mind talking about myself, exposing things. I'm always sort of confused by our current state of culture where everyone is so overwhelmed and worried about security and making sure that nobody can get onto your computer and nobody can see what's on your phone and all those things. And I'm like, you know, I am who I am. I'm not too worried about what someone might find out. I'm not running for office.
Yeah. Well, I think it's all good. I think I'm not either, but it's also, you got to keep shots, your head shots separate from your dick shots. That's all.
Well,
right. Because then, then it can go too far, you blackmail right. And stuff, but
nudity is out.
Yeah. Well, nudity right where they now, can prove it's you, right. But it's about proof. No, I think what it is, what I mean is because, you can put certain feelings into a character and have it come out. And then nowadays people can review it and say, oh my God, who would think like that? What a stupid thing. And like they're kind of taking something, something important to you and they're making it seem kind of, whatever.
Well, you've read the book. Exactly. What are you talking about, sir?
Well, chapter 16, when you're talking, talking about your poor mother. Let's talk.
I understand what you're saying. And I think it's true that there's you reveal yourself much more in print and it's in print. And so, whereas, somehow there's especially with what I've been doing in the last decade or so, making documentaries about other people, I'm really revealing their past and traumas and foils and successes. And whereas with something like this, you begin to immediately wonder with the writer, well, which part of this is him and what does he really believe? And, do I have a murderous streak in me or am I ready to go rob a bank? You can kind of wonder, I think, more about the writer. And I agree with you that we do live in a time where almost anything you say can be twisted, turned. I have a very good friend, who shall remain nameless to protect her.
Oh, please.
who did a blog in Portland, and the town turned on her. And it was interesting. She said it was that experience that you see on TV where suddenly, you've got reporters in your yard.
Yeah. As long as they're good looking.
Well, as long as they send a dick pic first.
Yeah. Of course, that makes it all worthwhile. You also then sort of have to because with these characters, okay, and who you've got going here, and you end up he's in a love affair with a woman and then he's kind of falling for a guy down the road, but do you feel like you have to be careful in political correctness terms?
Well, I mean, I am a feminist, and I wear a t-shirt sometimes that says this is what a feminist looks like.
Yeah.
So I'm careful about making sure that I give strong representation to who that woman is, instead of kind of throwing her under the bus. Oh, men always go for men and toss the woman aside. It was, I was trying to make her powerful, interesting, and important in the story, and that in many ways she drives the story. So in that particular kind of arena, I'm careful already because I care, and I would say that ends up being a lot of what can sometimes drive decision making in writing. Also, what I think happens sometimes is that quite unaware, you will do something, draw something, and not know that it's, incendiary or offensive. So, being careful is one thing, and just expressing yourself and then finding out, oh, wow, that really pushed some buttons, is another. But I haven't had that happen yet. I haven't had somebody come up to me yet and say, why did you X with this character? Why did this person do this? Why did this person do that? My publisher was very good about sometimes words and saying, do you really want to use this word here about, you know, a certain character? The word that came up was gypsy.
Oh, right.
Right? Yeah. That I had talked about Ramon's background, and he is Mexican-American, and, you know, that his parents were gypsies. And he was saying, you know, that's not as accepted a term anymore.
Right, right. Do you have the same publisher as me? I got to look this up. Because I was having some issues with that. And also when I used the term ghetto, oh my God.
Right. You know.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying about being careful and why I think it is good, which is that if we take a second to think, is there a better word than gypsy? Is there a better word than ghetto? And I do that through the whole book. I mean, you know, I stop myself and say, you know, can I get a stronger verb there, whatever it might be. So if there's a word that's potentially offensive to someone and that's not my intention, I'm happy to look at it and think about what I might say instead.
Yeah, but I think, for me, I'm primarily nonfiction and true stories. And a lot of times, these characters are who they are. I can't really alter them. And that kind of leads to the issues I have with publishers in that sense, because they say the things they do, they act and react the way they are because of who they are. And I can't really filter it too much, because then it starts to become not real. You know, it starts to, I'm polishing the characters. But with you in this fiction, I just wonder if, could you go too far and polish it too much? Because some of these words are
feel like,
yeah.
When things are in quotation marks, it belongs to the character, and you're much more allowed to kind of do whatever that character might say. So in your case, when you're writing true/real people, and it's not you calling something ghetto, it's that somebody called something ghetto or, you know, used a word that you might not use.
Yeah. Yeah, I went through that experience, but you still can't win. Just so you know, you can't, because then you're presenting that to the people, then that means you're giving that person exposure and so you can't win. I fought that fight for 20 years and
I actually got taken slightly to task for being mean to Desert Hot Springs. You know, the movie, the book. See, I'm still bad at talking about movie versus book. But the book, takes place that they commit their crime in Los Angeles and then they hide out in Palm Springs. But they end up with a stop in Desert Hot Springs, and I describe it in very unfriendly terms. And people in the valley, which is what they sort of call the Coachella Valley, the Palm Springs area, took me to task for it. And I said, well, it wasn't me saying it, it was my character saying it. And the writer interviewing me said, well, that's a cop-out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a point. You always get taken. Now, I figured you were the character Shelley for sure.
Well, she's the English major. She's the former English major, and she is the mastermind behind everything. I would say that if I were to commit, I'd say I am Frank.
Frank dressed as Frank Shelley.
Is the lead male character, right?
Yeah.
And he wanted to be a singer, and ends up being a disgruntled professor and finds himself kind of pulled along by the dreams of potentially getting what he finally wanted. And I'd say maybe I fall a little bit more into his category than I do into Shelley's ability to mastermind the whole thing. but there's a lot of me and Shelley. Ramon's much too handsome. There's no way I could be him.
That's what we're supposed to, Dave, kick in there. You're supposed to say, but you're far too handsome. What are you talking
Absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. Yes. It's falling. You interrupted me before I had the chance.
Oh, sorry.
Right. Yeah, there we go.
Oh, no. More handsome than Ramon.
Yeah. Here, you know. Oh, that's terrible.
I don't believe any of it. Whatever you guys say now, that's it.
Okay. But at the end of the book, so when someone picks up your book, they read it. At the end of it, is there some sort of a subtext or something that you want people to take away from the book? A something besides the entertainment and the the journey, so to speak, across the top. And, you know, and this I ask because it could happen intentionally, but it could also happen organically in a story.
Yeah, you know, I write tragedy. I tend to write tragedy. And so what I really feel like happens when you see something that ends tragically is that as an audience member, you walk out of the experience with that in mind, wanting that to not happen that way. And so I think it affects your choices immediately afterwards, that it's like you see how this went in a downward spiral because of the choices that got made by these characters. And I think it helps you to say, well, you know, life shouldn't be like that. I don't want that to happen. And I think that that's more activist than a happy ending where you get to walk out and go, well, that worked out. It was scary there for a minute, but it all worked out great. So I can walk home and not think about that any further. So, you know, there are choices that the characters make in the ways that they fail to reach each other, I think, that brings about their own kind of downfall. And so I think that there's a warning inside of it. It's always hard with mystery fiction because you're trying not to give anything away, right? Like you can't say, well, when he does this, then that, you know.
What do you think attracts you to, you know, personally to writing tragedy?
I mean, it's, as you can tell, I'm not a very dark person. I mean, I actually see a lot of the bright side of life. But I do think that it is a powerful format. And I do think that it makes us think in the way that, you know, say, romantic comedy doesn't. So to me, I think it's it draws us in. It plays to our dark side. It makes us have to really kind of churn about in thought. And I like that. So, and I've always kind of been attracted to it. People have said to me that that sometimes I don't match my material because it can be so dark.
Yeah, but they say that about serial killers too.
Well,
he was the nicest guy.
He was the nicest guy. We never would have guessed. He used to play Santa Claus at the right. at the mall, and you know, yeah. So
I always tickled my dog under the chin.
Yeah, where you're not fooling us. So that's interesting. So what do you think you learned from the process of writing?
Well, I certainly learned I want to do more of it. I very much enjoyed it. I think that the difference really between writing screenplays and writing novel is that it is done and it is what it is when it's finished. And a screenplay, you write towards this idea that suddenly millions of dollars are going to show up and this thing is going to end up on the screen. And that happens so rarely that, you know, you do a lot of writing that doesn't exist, because if a film doesn't get filmed, it isn't a film, where a book is a book is a book. So it's been great to write, to have it be something that gets out there and that people can read, is supremely satisfying. The other thing I think that I tapped back into was the original desire when I was young that I wanted to write. And it's been kind of validating to know that I can. I mean, I have been a writer. My whole life I've been a writer to some extent. Even when you're doing documentary films, you are writing. I always say the editing process is the writing of a documentary film. But that this voice exists, and that when I sat down to do it, it was there, is also very satisfying.
So anything you would have done differently?
You know, I already kind of have ideas for a sequel. And so I guess if I were to have done anything differently, I maybe might have taken more time and made the whole book longer because people are already telling me what a quick, fast, fun read it is. Now that's a compliment, except for that often, I mean, I'm doing readings and people are buying my book and telling me 2 days later how much they enjoyed the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it's a little too short.
Yeah.
So, maybe Daddy should have taken a little bit more time and sat down and thought up more of what happens next. But yeah. I don't think that anything that I did internally, I would have fleshed out further, but I can see already that there is more story to tell as I've been ruminating where things would go from what happens at the end of the book. So I could see that if I were to do it differently, and when I do it again, I think I will try to push myself towards length.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Not just length, but more, and that it's okay to take your time. I think when you are trained in screenplay, you really do try to get to the point. You've got 90 minutes to tell a story.
Right.
Robert Wise, great filmmaker, did West Side Story and, you know, 100 other things, once told my husband when he was doing a website for him, if you can't tell a story in 90 minutes, you can't tell a story. And I think that's very true in film. He's also the guy who made Sound of Music, which goes on and on and on forever. But perhaps that's where he learned it.
Yeah.
But, but in general, I think that, you know, we think that way as filmmakers. Let me put this together, get to the point, fulfill the action, fulfill the story. And when you write a book, you have so much more latitude.
Right. So you can do length and girth in a book.
Right? Correct. Okay. Well, you know, one of the dreams has always been that idea of the spine in the bookstore, that you would go down the shelf at a bookstore in the E's, and you'd be able to pull out, you know, Ebersole, my book, right, under E. And I was at Powell's Books in Portland.
Yeah.
And the mystery section, and they had my book, and I was very close to the James Ellroy section.
Oh.
Because, you know, E-B-E-L, and those were much fatter books, and his name was much larger on the pine. And I thought, girth.
Oh, I know. That's the first thing that comes to mind when I'm in a bookstore. It's girth.
They are sexy. Bookstores are sexy.
Yeah, and that's a different bookstore anyway. Wow. So how was your process? How do you find that? And because you mentioned the you know, the pandemic, which I heard it was fake, but the pandemic. So you're sitting there and you're at home, but are you that type of guy that can sit down and just go, okay, well, I'm writing 5 hours today, Monday to Friday, that's it. And you turn on the clock and you can do it. Or does all of this craziness outside of you sort of interfere? Like, you know, you have Donald Trump as your president and you've got all this weird stuff going on. Does it affect your writing?
I'm actually really no good at the setting the clock and saying I'm going to write. When I was young, I read an article. I had gone away to Spain to write, and I had read an article in Esquire magazine about writers who write, and they all talked about locking themselves in a room at 9 o'clock in the morning and not letting themselves out until five. And I just felt horrible because I was like, God, I'm never going to be that person. I can't do it. I stare at the ceiling and I watch TV and I procrastinate and I clean the whole house. So what I find is that I really have to retreat. I have to go away. Mm-hmm. And so I have to remove myself from all of those distractions and all of the things that I will choose to do instead of write, because I'll do pretty much anything but if given the chance. So, but I also now, I mean, I'm 58. And I have learned that I have, over the years, been a very productive person. So I'm no longer hard on myself about the idea of what I do to get there. And whatever it might be, if it takes, you know, watching Ellen in the afternoon to be able to get me to sit down and write a page or two, then that's what it is. So I don't really beat myself up at it anymore, but I do get a way to do it. So last year, I had this idea growing, and I went to Provincetown and spent not the whole summer, but you know, a portion of the summer there. And that's where the bulk of the book got written. And then when I got home and it was being published and I had to do the next work, I went up to Joshua Tree and rented a house and made myself complete the task. So I write in what I call rhythm, which is that I really can't go forward without being in it. And so if I take time off, then I have to start all over. not start all over with the writing, but start all over by reading through it, writing along with it, to get myself back into the rhythm of what I've done so that I can go forward. And so it works much better for me to do the retreat where every day, even if I'm only doing a little, I get something done.
So you get right into your character. You're like one of those method actors, right? You kind of like get into it, into the story.
Yeah, and shut everything else out for a minute. Yeah. I think that's true. I think that, you know, to work. And I think maybe that also comes from the concept of filmmaking and editing, which is that, you know, we often have a deadline. And so I'll be, you know, have all my footage together, you know, my husband and I, for our next documentary, and we have to turn it into something. And we have film festival deadlines, or, you know, people that we promised the film to by a certain time or date. And so there is a real completion ethic that goes on about must sit down, must work, you know, force yourself to you know, to get those sequences done. And the sequences are usually in my head. I write in what I call tent poles. So I know, for instance, in a book like this, that I have these three characters. I need to make them all come together and meet. I need them to decide to do the crime. I need the crime to happen. I need them to do the getaway. I need things to go wrong, et cetera. And I have those tent poles in my head, but I don't block it out for myself. I don't put a bunch of cards on the wall. I don't make an outline. I don't really know where it's going to go as I'm writing. I let the characters enter scenes and go from there.
Yeah, did you dress up like your characters? Like you dressed like Shelley? And...
I only dress up as Amber Heard.
Amber Turd. Well, Dave, someone's stealing your show. I don't know what you're going to do now.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, have your characters, in writing this way, have your characters done anything to surprise you? Do they just go off the rails and kind of take over the plot?
They kind of always surprise me. I mean, I find inside of scenes, I mean, I guess that the one thing that I will say is that I do know where they're going. And so they can't go completely off the rails, because they do have to get to what is already kind of set up in my mind of what I think is going to happen. But for instance, there is a kind of wild scene at the end of this book where, when everything really goes wrong, you know, I didn't know who would be left standing.
Wow. Hmm.
Because I thought, well, they're going to get in that room and it's going to happen. And I didn't quite know exactly how that was going to play out. And that's kind of almost like improv, right? You're getting actors together and letting them kind of, you know, from their personal intentions, go through the motions of what they would do. And sometimes it will surprise you, the direction that it will end up taking. So I do let those kind of things happen organically.
It's interesting. So,
and in all my writing, and also in all of our documentary filmmaking, we go in again knowing those tent poles, but we do not know how we're going to, you know, shape it, or how the ending is going to happen, or what's going to come before something else. And often when you're making a documentary, you discover things about people you didn't know, because again, they're speaking truthfully from themselves. And you had this idea of this thing that you were going to try to say with this documentary, and then out comes Pierre Cardin saying something completely different than you thought. You're like, oh, well, he's really not that person. He's this person.
Yeah. He expresses his girth. His length.
Or perhaps his length, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Where do you see stuff going now? So you said you're going to do a sequel, maybe, or maybe not?
Yeah, well, you know, without revealing too much, the end of 99 Miles from L.A. does end in Mexico. And we sold our house in Palm Springs and bought a house in Mexico this year. So I'm going. And when I get there, I kind of feel like that will inform a lot of what I'm feeling should be going into what I think this next book is. And it wasn't on purpose. I mean, again, the character sort of wrote the story himself, the character of P. David Ebersole decided to buy a house in Mexico while he was writing a book about it. So the idea of being an expat, the idea of being in a different culture, bringing our culture to it, is a lot of, I think, what's going to start kind of going into the next book. I have a title for it, knowing that I do want to use the characters of this book and that I kind of want it to spin off, which is 24 Hours from Tulsa, the Gene Pitney song, which likewise sounds kind of like this positive, fun song about, I'm 24 hours away from you, darling. I'm on my way to Tulsa. I'll be there in a minute. But truthfully, what happens is that the main character of the song stops in a motel 24 hours away from his beloved, has an affair, and falls in love with that person instead. So the song is really saying, I almost made it, but I'm not going to get there. Yeah. Well, there once again is a cheery place to jump off of to start my next book.
Wow, boy, you're just all full of fun. And so when you're down in Mexico and then the authorities discover all the bodies that were parked under your house,
right?
So
back at the old house, right?
Yeah.
And the house that is described in 99 Miles from LA is my now former house in Palm Springs. So, you know, it is possible that the HOA could go in there looking for Bobby.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a reason why this tree could never grow. Oh, boy. So now in this ever-changing world, how do you like to be found by readers and fans and people that, or maybe people that don't like you? Do you have a website? Do you have social media? What's your way of doing it?
You know, I enjoy Facebook the most, to tell you the truth. I know I'm old, but I do like it the best because to me, it's still a storytelling format. So I have a strong presence on Facebook, both for the book and for my own self. And then I'm really trying to learn Instagram and get myself into that as well. So there's a 99 Miles page for Instagram and a P. David Ebersole page on Instagram as well. Instagram's much more public, and you know, Facebook, you can kind of keep your own circle together, which I like. But and then we have a website for our company, which is ebersolehughes.com.
Wow. Okay. So we're going to put all that up on the website too, so people can find you with one click without a lot of our listeners can't read.
Which is why they're listening.
Yeah, that's why they're listening.
Right?
They
you know what? There is an audio version of the book as well. So, so
perfect.
Your readers are incapable.
You are in there. Like, and, you know, we really want, like, come on, people, give them some really good mail. Tell them what you think.
Right? Yeah, you can do comments under Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, that's always frightening, the comment section.
Do you follow those or do you stay away from them?
Well, it depends on for me, mostly, which movie, right, where I can go back. And if I need to sort of feel good, I can look up the comments under movies I know the public likes. Like Sally Field and Soap Dish going to the mall to, like, have people, you know, come around her and go, oh, you're the lady in the soap opera. Yeah. So sometimes I can go and go, like, oh, wow, look, see, people really like that movie. Yeah. But then there's ones you have to stay away from.
Yeah. Well,
the one you know that everybody hated.
Yeah, but you could always hunt them down. You know,
I mean, well, you know, I don't love that culture that there are comments below everything, because I do believe that there was a culture of review that used to happen, and it's been exploded. I mean, there's really nobody that we listen to anymore specifically, like we might have listened to Pauline Kael back in the day about films. Everybody has an opinion. That's a great thing, but it also means that, you know, you get trolls, you get people who, you know, just have said something horrible and incorrect about something that you've done, and you can't get rid of it. So it travels along with you, but
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's the modern world.
Yeah. And that's why I hunt them down. I'm not taking it. I write about them in a true crime book or something, you know.
Exactly. Just kill them off in the next book. That's
and,
great.
And, you know, make sure they suffer, you know. But no, it's all good, you know, and stuff. You know, who do you look for inspiration, or do you?
No, I really do. You know, when I wrote this, I reread some of the things that I do love. And so, for instance, my favorite book is Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin. And I love Joan Didion and her specificity. And so I rewatched a couple of kind of noirish kind of films that have always mattered to me, like After Dark, My Sweet, and Gilda, which I love. So, you know, to get yourself in the tone and in the mood. But I also, for this book, because one of the things that happens in writing a novel is that you get to express that which is not necessarily seen. In a film, you have to write what's on screen. And here you get to write what's in people's heads, or you can write scenery and what's going on. I went back and watched all the old Antonioni films because I wanted to sort of have that experiential component to it, where sometimes it's just the leaves blowing is what matters. So I do always, I think, kind of write with inspiration surrounding me. I like to go back to the people I love. I actually have a clear Lucite desk at home, and I load it with visual inspiration when I'm working and writing. So the drawers, everyone always says, how can you work at this desk? You know, stay neat. But it's really because, you know, you have a messy cabinet over to the right, but the but the desk itself is like a display case. So you can kind of put things in it and have it creep on up into the computer.
And is it pictures of girth?
You are stuck on that.
I am. It's fascinating. It's fascinating.
Ever since I talked about my next book being big and fat.
It's a fascinating word. Fascinating word. Well, people, you know, we need you to come buy this book. Great book. It's called 99 Miles from L.A. And the writer has been our guest, Mr. P. David Ebersole. So thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you. And what fun. You never know if it's going to be fun, right? You come on and you think, well, maybe it's going to be serious. But this was great fun.
Thanks, David.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.